interrupting the current neo-uranial climate-challenged, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM 590. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport, so get you behind the woodshed because you don't know what you missed until you get behind the woodshed. It's pretty much that simple. Time for you folks in the land down under to get you behind the woodshed, to be free of those that would poison your little ones, as we hear more and more horrors coming out of that place. I don't know what happened to y'all, as they try to apparently put your little ones in a state of obese stupor. Shocking study, well, after the lockdowns as well. Shocking study finds Australia's food being sold to children fails to meet WHO standards. A little caveat, if we can trust those standards. However, they have to have some credibility, otherwise no one would listen to them. And so we can kind of follow the basics if you have nothing else to follow. The study comes after a meeting between Australian and New Zealand food ministers in July, who decided to launch a probe into the commercial foods for infants and children following a sharp increase in obesity-related diseases. Just all of a sudden. Research led by the George Institute of Global Health found that more than three-quarters of the products being sold for children's consumption failed overall nutritional requirements, while all items being sold failed to meet, quote, promotional requirements, a British news source wrote, citing the recent study. The study looked at more than 300 foods being offered to children ages 6 months old to 3 years old in Australian supermarkets and compared the children's food to the WHO Regional Office for Europe's Nutrition and Promotion Profile model. Only about a fifth of the products, about 22%, that they studied met all criteria for nutrient consumption, with high sugar content being the main culprit. So they said, this is, to my mind, a call to an alarm to really start looking at your food, just about everywhere, actually. Because children will prefer foods that are sweet, manufacturers will add sweeteners to a range of products in the hopes of influencing more purchases in the future, said Dr. Daisy Coyle, a dietitian and author of the paper. But this proposes a problem for how the child will eat as an adult because, quote, kids are developing taste and food preferences that set them up for life, she added. The study also found maybe just crackers, just plain old pilot crackers. That might be something. The study also found that none of the products being sold met their, quote, promotional requirements, close quote, meaning foods which had at least one or more claim on its packaging prohibited under the WHO model included free from colors and flavors or organic and no added sugar. Foods with sub-promotional claims related to allergies, religious claims, and vegetarian-vegan claims are permissible. The researchers also found one in three products to be deceiving in the name of the product, not matching that of the ingredients list. If a product is called broccoli, spinach, and apple, parents grocery shopping may assume it's an equal blend when in fact it may be made up of 70% apple puree, which has significantly more sugar than either broccoli or spinach. And speaking of the state of super stupor, scientists develop a new ultrasound technology that uses powerful pulses that can induce immediate hibernation. Some animals are able to limit the drawbacks of that situation by introducing torpor, which turns down many of those processes and means that they use less energy but are all able to come back to living as normal after without damage to their bodies. Humans are not able to do that, but if they were, it would be incredibly useful, which has led to the search for a non-invasive, safe, reliable way of inducing that state. The scientists found that directing ultrasound pulses at mice's heads for around 10 seconds brought on the same condition as torpor, with their heartbeat slowing, their body temperature cooling, and their metabolism slowing. The system can be aimed at the head and bring on torpor, a state similar to hibernation where mammals suppress their metabolism and reduce their body temperature and slow down the other processes. The researchers behind the new system successfully brought it on in mice and rats after pointing the ultrasound pulses to the animals' heads. They suggest that it could work in humans and might have important applications for long-distance space travel or medicine, they said. While further work is needed to understand how it might work on people, they suggest that it could be used when people have experienced acute emergencies or severe diseases, for instance. If someone is in a car accident, for instance, they could essentially be put on ice until their organs are used for transplantation, for instance. It might also be used in long journeys through space, where it would help reduce the amount of resources that people might stay alive if they are traveling to Mars or other distant locations. So one more use that came to my mind was being frozen in carbonite, like they did to Han Solo in Star Wars when his social credits ran out. And I'm having a little bit of trouble with this next study. The language wasn't quite right as I was reading through it, but I don't have the time nor connectivity to do a better and more perfect proof of it, to prove it's all out. But I thought it was very important enough. If it is legitimate, you all need to hear about it, because it dovetails with the prior and similar findings we've heard about it a couple years ago, where we have real-time self-assembly and stereo microscopically visible artificial constructions in the incubated specimens of mRNA products, mainly from Pfizer and Moderna, a comprehensive longitudinal study. Observable real-time injuries at the cellular level in recipients of the safe and effective COVID-19 injectables are documented here for the first time, with the presentation of a comprehensive description and analysis of observed phenomena. Let me go back to those kids with all of a sudden obesity-related disease. See how they did that? I hope you picked up that. That's what I was pointing to. We're talking about this kind of stuff as well, inside all that. The global administration of these often mandated products from late 2020 triggered a plethora of independent research studies of the modified RNA injectable gene therapies, most notably those manufactured by Pfizer and Moderna. Analysis reported here consists of precise laboratory bench science aiming to understand why serious debilitating prolonged injuries and many deaths occurred increasingly without any measurable protective effect from the aggressively marketed products. Yeah, I would have you note the lack and absence of the word vaccine here as well. The contents of COVID-19 injectables were examined under the stereo microscope at about 400 times magnification. In addition to cellular toxicity, our findings reveal numerous on the order of 3 to 4 times 106 per milliliter of the injectable, visible artificial self-assembling entities ranging from about 1 to 100 micrometer or greater of many different shapes. They were animated, worm-like entities, discs, chains, spirals, tubes, right-angle structures containing any and other artificial entities within them, and so forth. All these are exceedingly beyond any expected and accepted levels of contamination of the COVID-19 injectables, and incubation studies revealed that the progressive self-assembly of many artificial structures, as time progressed during incubation, simple one- and two-dimensional structures over 2 or 3 weeks became more complex in shape and size and developing into stereoscopically visible entities in 3 dimensions. They reassembled carbon nanotube filaments, ribbons, and tapes, some appearing as transparent, thin, flat membranes, and others as 3-dimensional spirals and beaded chains. Some of these seem to appear and then disappear over time. Our observations suggest the presence of some kind of nanotechnology in the COVID-19 injectables. In another article that pulls together the study in a possibly more readable way, as I will give you the link in the blogcaster, is explained by this next author. Another confirmation of self-assembly nanotechnology in COVID bioweapons. Remarkable longitudinal study and culture work of COVID shots for up to 12 months in cellular toxicity studies. New Japanese data proves Pfizer and Moderna V*** scenes contain unauthorized animated worm-like entities invisible to the human eye, which swim, wiggle, and assemble themselves into complex structures, which cause clots inside the body. What embalmer Richard Hirschman found and exposed in the film died suddenly. Dr. Young Mai Li and Dr. Daniel Browdy from Okinawa Christian University discovered these, quote, undisclosed additional engineered components, close quote, by isolating unused vax vials for 3 weeks and then examining them under the 400 power magnification. So those of you that are interested, you get these studies, you can get the links to the study and read it yourself. Qualify it. It qualifies more what happened in the Spanish study that went on real early on. So those of you that are interested need to keep up with that. This is the latest and the greatest, I suppose, on what they've been looking at. Qualify what they're doing. My main contention was it was, because it was so anti, there's no word vaccine in those articles, it seemed to have more of an antagonistic view to the whole concept of it anyway. I would be agreeable to it. What I'm saying is that the study, as a neutral unbiased study, I'm not so sure. And so you want to make sure for errors in that as well. Self-assembly of the internet equality has been obstructed as well here. Appeals court halts return to net neutrality. Because the board can't use agency deference after the Supreme Court overturned the two long-standing Chevron case. It sounds to me, when you look at these things, the Sixth Circuit's temporary stay comes only weeks after the Supreme Court overturned Chevron deference, weakening the FCC. Every agency, folks. I went through that. Very big deal, those cases. The Federal Appeals Court has agreed to halt the reinstatement of net neutrality rules until August the 5th, while the court considers whether more permanent actions is justified, and I couldn't find anything from that date to the current, and I would assume it's actually paper filings in the court that are still ongoing, and there won't be much news until those are rendered a bit. It's the latest setback in a long back and forth on the net neutrality. It's the principle that the internet service providers, or ISPs, should not be able to block or throttle internet traffic in a discriminatory manner. The Federal Communications Commission has sought to achieve this by reclassifying ISPs under Title II of the Communications Act, which gives the agency greater regulatory oversight. The Democratic-led agency enabled net neutrality rules under the Obama administration, only for those rules to be repealed under the President Donald Trump's FCC. The current FCC, which has three Democrat and two Republican commissioners, voted in April to bring back net neutrality. The 3-2 vote was divided along party lines. Along party lines, folks. And you might have thought that the justice system had a political bias to bring the law. You see it in the agencies, too. We're not looking at serving you. But it must be the smell of democracy in the morning here, because it sure as heck isn't keeping the republic, as we should understand it. Broadband providers have since challenged the FCC's actions, which is potentially more vulnerable after the Supreme Court's recent decision to strike down Chevron deference, a legal doctrine that instructed courts to defer to an agency's expert decisions, except in a very narrow range of circumstances. A panel of judges in the Sixth Court of Appeals said in an order that a temporary administrative stay is warranted while it considers the merits of the broadband provider's request for permanent stay. And again, the refiling of the paperwork in these cases because of that Chevron deference being removed. And we also now know it's strict scrutiny. And then the Supreme Court's also looking at the power of Congress, what it has to be able to do. And so there's a number of an analysis that has to go in, reanalysis now that actual Chevron burden, it's an absolute unconstitutional imposition, was put on us, and now we're going to see how this works out, and it may or may not be good for us. We will see. And keep in mind here, the censorship or biased search return algorithm programming and other unavoidable controls on all of these things, net neutrality and these concepts all built into this as well. And the Supreme Court saying, well, no, the government can't touch all that. And then look what the privateers start doing. These algorithm programming and other unavoidable controls are an insidious evil on us that want us to be careful of. And we might be witnessing an unscheduled disassembly of that. And because of it, and this is the dynamic of how this works, how this can work to adjust things. Google loses antitrust case. Judge rules company a monopolist. A judge ruled that Google has been unlawfully exploiting its dominance over competing companies Monday by stifling innovation, folks, in an effort to maintain dominance over the search engine industry. The lawsuit wrapped up nearly a year after the trial between the U.S. Justice Department and Google first began. I guess we're going to have baby Googles now after this. United States District Judge Amit Mehta of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia issued the decision after reviewing a year's worth of evidence, including testimonies from top executives at Google, Microsoft, and Apple. Google and the DOJ presented their closing arguments early in May. After having carefully considered and weighed the witness testimony and evidence, the court reaches the following conclusion. Google is a monopolist and it has acted as one to maintain its monopoly, Meta wrote in his 277-page ruling. The company paid billions of dollars a year to device makers like Apple and Samsung to have Google installed as the default search engine on those devices. This is the most important antitrust case of the century, and it's the first of a big slate of cases to come down against big tech, said Rebecca Haw Allensworth, a professor at Vanderbilt University's law school. It's a huge, huge turning point. Kent Walker, Google's president of global affairs, said the company intends to appeal the ruling. The company also faces a separate federal antitrust case over the ad technology that will go to trial next month. So my thoughts on this is that if Google wants to monopolize the internet, don't be evil and then get caught is a thing. And so we might see baby Googles. I don't know. I don't know how that's going to really work out. And it'll be a nice thing not to have to work real hard to figure out how to get around Google. I don't know if anybody's trying to do that. You have to use a Google browser to get into a Google unless you have the program to load sideways. You have to go through a Google browser to get another browser that isn't Google. Pretty interesting how they have that locked in. Japan government bond future collapses as traders test BOJ as the Nikkei plunges by 12% as it registers largest ever point fall. The record financial collapse occurs as Japan's government bonds plunge, triggering circuit breakers and halts the market. If you actually thought this was a free market system. As markets around the world plunge during Monday's session when a combination of fears about a slowing U.S. economy, rising Japanese interest rates and crumbling tech stocks combined to trigger a meltdown. The traders betting that the bank, this is your money system, your financial system, your monetary system, traders betting, this big casino that it is, that the Bank of Japan's ultra-easy monetary policy will be unsustainable have been blamed for the steepest plunge in the government bond futures in years. Again, blamed, but it's part of the rules. It's part of the game. It's part of the theater that we've have our lives tied to. But the downward pressure came as the monetary authority announced additional buying, leaving yields clinging to the upper limit of the central bank's policy band. The BOJ later announced additional purchases of securities for Thursday and Friday and reiterated it would continue to conduct additional operations based on market moves. It did not move the yield from the top of the bank's tolerance band, 25 basis points either side of zero. Benchmark 10-year JGB futures, which had opened lower, turned positive briefly after the central bank's initial announcement, then plunged sharply to close at the low of the day at 145.58, a level not seen since late 2014. The heavy selling triggered a circuit breaker at the exchange. Understand the precarious position Japan's in relative to the world market and what that's setting up these dominoes that the failure that are possibly coming fairly quickly, it seems. How fast does it take for a domino to fall? Japan is in a bond buying frenzy at this point to try and shore this all up with their basic buying it with fiat, which isn't going to last long, isn't going to really do much. Yields on shorter JBG tenors pulled back in the face of the BOJ's escalating bond buy, but they jumped in the super long sector, shorting JGBs in the hope that yields would spike. Has been known for over two decades as a widow-making trade, John Vale, chief global strategist at the Nikko Asset Management in Tokyo, wrote to a client in a note. Quote, while there certainly has been some profit in shorting the very long end of the curve, both historically and in recent months, taking on the firepower of the Bank of Japan, especially as it is led by the very strong-willed Governor Kuroda, will not likely end well. The late-breaking news shows here on this story that the ball bounced. It's bouncing down the stairs to the bottom. Japanese stocks rebound from the worst crash since 1987, while global markets are mixed. I wanted to re-highlight that because you saw in the article I just read, they wanted to talk about since 2014. No, this was a gigantic crash. All the way back in this other story we see admitted to be 1987. But, folks, it's all fine. Just fine. It's real fine. the bounce in Japan is typically after a market crash. Neil Newman, head of strategy of Asterisk Advisory in Tokyo, told CNN, importantly, fundamentals are sound. The economy is doing fine. There is no evidence of abandoning Japanese equity. Except Wall Street also took a beating, with all three major indexes falling between 2 to 6% and 3 to 4% on fears the U.S. economy was slowing faster than expected. Growing worries about a recession in the U.S. economy and the rapid unwinding of popular carry trades involving the yen had sent global markets into a tailspin starting Friday. Much of the market downturn reflects concerns that the U.S. may be heading for a recession, said analysts from Moody Analytics in a note Tuesday. So it doesn't sound good in a world of towering fiscal and monetary dominoes here. Most everyone but the officials believe we're already in a recession. Some people, such as myself here, are, as I've been talking, are anticipating the condition worse than the 70s. If you go back and look at that, and I bring this up, I'm not an economist. I'm not talking about economy giving advice. I'm saying look at the state of the world in the fiscal and economic and monetary policy and start to position yourself in the proper place so it doesn't run you down. This thing, if it goes worse than the 70s, will last a couple decades. Position yourself appropriately, if you still can. How fast is this coming? And as I think about that, the gold, the price of gold went over $2,500. It's now swinging, you know, $100 up and down. But it's going up, generally going up. And I also noticed it almost looked like they set this one up to take down silver relative to its trade rate, its ratio. It was, silver was moving up against gold, and now they get these big swings when it finally goes up above 2,500, but silver got knocked way down to 27, 28. And it was way up around 30, 31 at the same level. So there's lots of dynamics going on in money shifting right in front of our eyes that we may or may not see. The point is we don't have to worry about that. We shouldn't be living in the casino, and we should be looking at more solid monetary mediums for ourselves, which would be gold and silver coin. Go to the coin. And start to make a practice. But we're watching the prediction of the economy's failing because of fiat right happening now, and all the evidence is around us. And we can put our head in the sand, or we can start taking as much responsibility as we can right now to try and buffer the tsunami that's coming. Again, mostly will hit all the casino makers, but then it rolls downhill. The tsunami comes in from the lowlands, and that's where all of us sit on whatever we're doing, because we have opted to engage the products of a fiat system. About everywhere you look, and gold and silver coin, and a couple of other things, and trade, production, your skills, those are not subject to that. So as the wheels come off the economy, the ripples are felt everywhere, even by other Silicon Valley debased evils, fake things. Now, Silicon Valley debased evils, here's an unnatural expensive, subsidized, unsustainable power that the green mind virus will complain is failed capitalism, which I find an irony, or would that be a silly conny, heavy on the con, as it were? Not irony at all. Bay Area solar company SunPower, once worth $10 billion, files for bankruptcy. SunPower, so I read this dry old article about some market in Japan, but this is these things are happening before what happened in Japan. This is a watching history move before it even hits those banks. The support for an internal economy is failing. And part of it is part of this green religion that was subsidy-based. All government spending, but no good returns. Bay Area solar company SunPower, once worth $10 billion, is filing bankruptcy. SunPower, a corporation, a once mighty solar panel company based in Richmond, filed for bankruptcy on Monday in a Delaware court. It marks the end of a road of a 39-year-old business, which will now look to find buyers for its assets, pay back creditors, and quell customers' uncertainties. California's regulators reduced incentives for property owners to buy solar panels, while America's high interest rates have made such upfront investments more expensive. And helping that downfall is China's ability to manufacture solar panels. They saw the future, and they just turned it on. They made chips like crazy. And now it's growing domination in all things high-tech, and the Bidenomics regime's hackneyed responses in trying to maintain control is making things worse for us. And this is no different than the sanctions against Russia that backfired again, spitting in a hurricane. These countries were prepared. They watched this thing coming. And I was telling you about it as it went. Geopolitical risks and decoupling, evidence from U.S. export controls. Amid the current U.S.-China technological race, the U.S. has imposed export controls to deny China access to strategic technologies. We document that these measures prompted a broad-based decoupling of U.S. and Chinese supply chains. Remember we talked about decoupling the yuan from the dollar years and years ago. Now you see the production being done so as well, while Chinese has taken advantage in how to do that. When we offshored our production, I told you this years and years ago, was probably the biggest mistake that we ever made was to offshore our technological production capacity. And that was a field I was in. So you could watch how that was not going to work. And that was right after the 10-year period after the 70s, economic downturn in the 70s. We had to go through 10 years of, if you will, economic austerity, where the prices went way up. Gasoline in 1 year went from 25 cents a gallon to $2 a gallon. It didn't stop. It just kept going. And so this is what we were saying, interest rates in the 80s, right? At the end of the 80s, interest rates were sitting at 20, you think 7% bad now for a mortgage? It was 21% rising at that time. And so watching that and looking today, you see China understood what they were doing to make their production, their skill, their ability to produce important. Once the Chinese customers are subject to export controls, U.S. suppliers are more likely to terminate relations with Chinese customers, including those not targeted by export controls. However, we find no evidence of reshoring or friendshoring. And as a result of these disruptions, affected suppliers have negative abnormal stock returns, wiping out $130 billion in market capitalization and experience a drop in bank lending, profitability, and employment. That reflects directly on the economy of the United States, as we just talked about it in Japan. You see that as well. It highlights that the benefits of U.S. export controls, namely denying China access to advanced technology, may be limited as a result of Chinese strategic behavior. Indeed, there is evidence that the following U.S. export controls, China has boosted domestic innovation and self-reliance and increased purchase from non-U.S. firms that produce similar technology to the U.S.-made ones subject to export controls. So, this is huge. The Federal Reserve is saying that the U.S. shot itself in the foot in its export controls on China, or as illustrated, for instance, by Intel's recent layoffs, is the picture we didn't want to see painted. In other words, it's almost an absolute loss for U.S. firms who lose customers, revenue and market capitalization, and Chinese companies find alternative suppliers. The result is China boosts its domestic innovation and self-reliance, as seen, for instance, in the latest relatively capable microchip production and cell phone offerings that is coming out of China because of these. So you can read the full document here from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York with a link at behind the Witcher broadcaster if you want. Again, just touching base. The Fed now is coming out to say that the way the Bidenomics is really going to be just about everybody that puts any kind of restrictions on companies outside are actually just, again, spitting into the hurricane, shooting themselves in the foot. It's not going to go well for us as countries decouple as well from the dollar and create their own way, which I told you is actually the plan. Bring all the countries into parity, drop the big ones down to middlings, and then bring the lower ones up to midlands, and then they can do that basket of currency trading, utilizing that existing global financial system. That's not going away. I've shown you, every country is pointing to it. So towards a rapid, unplanned disassembly, decoupling you from your economic securities, we hear a story. We should all just love to hear these stories. Every American Social Security number address may have been stolen in a hack. In brief, on this story as well, again, the link for the more expanded story if you want to read more about it, a hacking group called the USDOD claims to have stolen 2.7 billion, Bravo, 2.7 Bravo records of personal information from Americans, including their social security numbers and physical addresses. The USDOD offered to sell the stolen records, which included personal data for everyone in the US, UK, and Canada, to a firm of hackers. The data was stolen from the National Public Data, a platform that offers personal information to employers, private investigators, and staffing agencies, and others doing background checks. What if I tell you about the third-party liability for years now? And it's gone! It's like we've been hearing. Welcome to your token citizenship here in the Siberian Gulag, along with your third-party liability to it, as I've been saying. It's like not going to be never-ending as we move this thing through this way. And so it's really your choice. Do you want to stay into the products of fiat system, or do you just settle down, get back into silver and gold, do coins, do your hand-to-hand trading, as you will, learn some of the language there so the tax man can't come after you, what you're doing with your livelihood and your sustenance to keep you going in the minimum, and try to keep them off your back, it off your back. And that may be the way forward, but it's not something that you can set a plan to as far as en masse. Everyone has to come to it and start to implement it for them. And that's what makes it so hard to look at some of these things and realize there's answers, but it may not be very, it's not very easy to just give everybody the same answer because everybody's different. It is a case-by-case basis. Everybody has different capacities. And for evidence of being beyond mental decoupling, UK doctors ordered to ask men if they're pregnant regarding X-ray or CAT scan. The NHS reportedly issued a new guidance after an expecting transgender person had a CT scan which could endanger the fetus. The British health authorities... Okay, let me just stop there. Doesn't that say there is a difference between men and women, whatever your feelings? Isn't that proof right there? A transgender person that endangered a fetus, to my mind, unless it's one of those baking bags that you put a little lamb in that I reported on, that they're growing lambs to birth, a baking bag in a man, that this would have been a woman who felt like she was a man who has a fetus. They don't explain that part. However, let's keep going. Mental decoupling right here. The inclusive pregnancy status guidelines for ionizing radiation was developed by the Society of Radiographers. According to the Telegraph, the guidance came in response to an incident with a transgender man had a CT scan while pregnant. Now, how do you do that? See, when I was telling you about that baking bag for making little lambs, that wasn't a joke. That was telling you the future. The decision was justified by the fact that the radiation from the X-ray, CT, and MRI scans can be harmful to unborn babies. So understand they've made a pod, a miniature pod that they can grow babies from fetuses, apparently. Doctors have therefore been told not to assume the gender identity of patients when performing all such procedures and inquiring of all people between the age of 12 and 55 about pregnancy, including men, transgender, non-binary, and intersex patients. I need to ask, how did that man was able to have a fetus without an operation that another doctor wouldn't have known about, or that there wouldn't be a record in the DHS about that? Now, I'm still questioning whether this was the man or someone who felt like they were a man on this story. Maybe somebody can help straighten me out, because I'm so confused. Another controversial aspect of the guidance is asking patients by which pronouns they would like to be addressed. Some parents and underage patients have all reportedly been furious that their kids were asked their preferred names and pronouns, a question that confuses them. I must be a kid. I'm so confused. While one doctor revealed that a patient started to doubt their own gender identity after filling out the form. And I think that's the key and the clue of what this actually does to people. Some doctors and human rights campaigners said, especially when you're jab harmed. Some doctors and human rights campaigners said that they considered the new guidelines humiliating the patients and said they have already appealed to the NHS to drop the system and return to common sense. Quote, given that it is impossible for anyone of a male sex to become pregnant, did you hear that, folks? Let's go back. I'm going to read that again. Pay attention here. Given that it is impossible for anyone of the male sex to become pregnant, there is no need to ask male people if they might be pregnant. The proposed radiography guidelines muddy the waters by including so-called intersex conditions, Dr. Louise Irving told the news outlet. And this is where I think we're looking at, you can test, well, I'll get to that in a second. This is an intersex may actually be birth deformities, where you don't get the right body parts relative to your chromosomal structure. But we're not being real clear as we talk through these articles, or when you go talk to them, it's all muddied, like she says here. It muddies the waters. These people that are mentally decoupled need to keep the waters muddied so they can continue swimming in muddy water, essentially. And everyone's confused. Where are we going? What are we doing? And common sense just floats away. The SRI's inclusion policy is among the worst examples of professional bodies losing their senses by prioritizing ideology ahead of biological fact. And I want people to consider that statement and always apply it. Because this is how they do it. They mash together your perspective and your feelings, and they shove it onto a qualifier of what we would find out would be a scientific or an objective basis. And they condition that factual basis by their sense of feeling or perception. In this case, they also mention ideology. Let me read that again. This is so important, this little statement. The SOR's inclusion policy is among the worst examples of professional bodies losing their senses by prioritizing ideology ahead of biological fact. And I'm going to touch that again right after we finish talking about this, about there is a way to prove, and it is the definitive way. But what they've done is they've prioritized ideology over fact, putting healthcare staff and male patients through this humiliating farce is both inappropriate and a shocking waste of time, Fiona McEnena, the head of Campaigns of Human Rights, Charity, and Sexual Matters, stated. And so I went over just real quick. I'm kind of interested in, there's a couple places on the internet you can ask AI questions. So I decided to make it real fast. I don't have a lot of time to be doing this anymore. So let's get the information what I can. And I'll just say, you need to deal with AI. I don't necessarily say get ChatGPT because it'll steal stuff from you. And it'll sell phone home. But if these, if you will, innocent, I know they're looking behind, but for you up front, innocent websites that have AI, they'll let you ask questions. Very interesting. I'll give you a link to the one I found and I use periodically. I asked the question of the AI. It's a G-Sheets formula generator. And it's called bubbleapps.io. But I asked the question, what is a definitive scientific difference identifying male from female? And the reason why I've decided to start asking some of these questions, because when you get on the internet, it's full of this conflated ideological impressions upon on facts, on scientific facts. It's getting very difficult to look through that. And I didn't have the time, so I asked the question of this AI. And I'm just talking about this because it's important that you understand, go find these places and ask questions and look very carefully on how it responds to you. Because as we move into having to deal with AI, you're going to have to understand how to deal with AI. There's a certain way to deal with it. And I find once you start picking, when you understand what it's doing and you frame your responses the way it is describing the world, because it doesn't know, the words it uses is its library. You frame your position relative to its response. You have to ask a question. The first one response comes back. You look very carefully at what it's saying, and you start to identify its library of language, and you frame your question relative to that language. And I'm finding the results come out much better. Not what I want to know, but they are more on point to what I want to know, and I get to take that information and go research it real quick to see if that was the case, if I haven't already done a research to check that the answers are coming back, to identify how I have to manipulate my question in order to have the AI give it back to me. So that's what I've been learning and what I want to do. It's a fascinating tool, as I said. But to do this, I said, well, what's the definitive scientific difference identifying males from female? Was the question I came up with to ask AI. The definitive scientific difference, it answers, in identifying a male from female lies in the sex chromosomes. Males, let me interject again, this is not unknown. This was biology 101, if we had a biology 101. This is why I also knew this is accurate. But this is confirmation for those that need to go and look and see if it's been buried anywhere. The definitive scientific difference identifying male from female lies in the sex chromosomes. Males typically have a 1X and 1Y chromosome, while females have 2X chromosomes. This genetic distinction determines the development of primary and secondary sexual characteristics. Now listen and keep track. This genetic distinction determines development of primary and secondary sexual characteristics, such as reproductive organs, hormonal profiles, and physical traits. The presence or absence of the Y chromosome is a fundamental determinant of an individual's biological sex. Keep track of these headings and what these are. If you don't, they're going to confuse you. Once I saw these stated, I was able to reorient my mind exactly what I thought. It wasn't the mandala effect. No, this is exactly what we've been taught. What's been happening is that they've been slowly changing the language to conflate all these ideological preferences onto a biological fact, the definitive biological fact in this sense. It's biological sex establishing the basis for the male-female binary in human reproduction. This chromosomal disparity underscores the different genetic instructions and pathways that drive the development of sexual dimorphism, shaping the diverse attributes and functionalities unique to each sex. Understanding the genetic underpinnings of sex determination is essential not only for biological research, but also for clinical applications, reproductive health considerations, and broader societal implications related to gender identity and sexual diversity. But for reproduction and for biological identification, the definitive test is the chromosome test, checking what the pair is. So definitively, that's a law, if you will, for us at this time, and to make things in life simple, we have to listen to what any official is talking about. And I've been listening now when I was reminded of this clarity of the biological sex determination, how the words used are muddied by the officials in order to get through, and I'm now kind of leaning towards discussing what happened at the Olympics, where we have what looks to me to be a guy, someone who responds and acts like a guy, who fights like a guy. And boxers are tough in some regard. A good woman who's trained really well and knows how they get a lot better at looking like a guy in their boxing style, because that's boxing. That's what that's about. You kind of have to do that. When you're fighting somebody, you have to do certain things that are counter and move and quick and all that and reflexive and all that. So those you just start to observe. But what you'll notice is that they start bringing in this identity stuff instead of the biological definition of what it is. And that's the distinction between the two things that happened at the two organizations that happened at the Olympics with these boxers. And so they're testing X and Y. If you say the biological sex test determines the sex, that would be correct. What they've done is they've added all this other stuff onto it, the ideological side, the feelings part, which is not biological sex. And those do not determine how the body will respond and make up. And then you have what I would consider are birth defects. So you have, let's say, X and Y, you may not have all the parts for an X and Y, a male. You may have female, but the birth defect, you have maybe male parts. Maybe you don't have some of your female parts. So there's what I would consider birth defects relative to the definitive biological standard. And so a lot of this could go down, unless you're trying to push an agenda, a lot of the biological facts are stated and proven and have to be agreeable because there's no other standard relative to that classification. In other words, for finding capacity and performance, you have to look at the definitive biological test. All those other things are irrelevant to that capacity. So the whole point here is there is a test. It isn't a question, and it's not clouded and muddied by identity, preferences, feelings, birth defects of any nature. As we start listening to these questions, you know, you have to ask men whether or not they're pregnant. No, that's, as the doctor said, it's impossible. And how they got a cooking bag for a little lamb to be carried by a man, and they call that a fetus, and call that actual pregnant, is kind of a fascination. And to not know about that, how did that guy, would the guy do that in the kitchen? He put that all together for himself in the kitchen, that no one knew about that? Now, relative to this identity and the conflation and the establishment of rights, special rights, no less. We're supposed to have no discrimination, but no, we get special rights. Now, the Supreme Court blocked Biden's Title IX rule in four states, dealing a blow to protections for LGBTQ plus students. Now, let's go back to that point. Four states, not all the states. And this becomes important, what I've told you behind the woodshed, relative to these laws and justice and getting the things determined in your way and whether or not they're standing to have an argument, whether you can develop it, and most likely how, why you have to develop it. If you want to have any kind of idea to have a say or a stopping these some ludicrous plans that come on that we find today in a 4-5-4 per curiam opinion, the Supreme Court has rejected President Biden's request to restore his Title IX rule, which would have expanded sex discrimination to include sexual orientation and gender identity while the appeals process continues. Let me go back right now what I just read about the AI response to what the test, the biological test is. The law does not recognize a feeling of perception. It recognizes a biological gender, if I can just read into that very first part. And so asking the executive asking to expand it has no authority, at least facially here, has no authority to expand it because Congress didn't actually intend that we would incorporate a mere perception, an ideology, onto what has been intended to be a biological fact. And so I read that other thing before to get to here to show us maybe why we're looking at they're being strictly decided relative to biological fact, not ideological preference. And I'm going to suggest once we allow ideological preference, your country doesn't exist anymore because that's anybody's opinion at any time. And I just don't know what more to say to tell someone how that would be so bad and why that removes your objective basis. That's the whole point about why it would be bad. So here we go. That's a crime. Someone says no. Yes, it is. No, it's not. We have no objective basis to know. Then eventually, crime becomes rampant because there's no way to know what crime is. What is a violation? What's a moral problem? What's a moral harm? There is none. And so they get the future they want. Well, there's no basis. If you have no basis to identify, we're talking about property as well here. You have no objective basis to identify a property. That could be you. And the law can only go so far to extend its protection if it can, or a benefit such that it is. And we go back to this case where the executive was redefining rules outside of the congressional intent, or what maybe the Congress could use as a standard. Justice Sotomayor filed a dissenting opinion in which Justice Kagan, Justice Gorsuch, and Justice Jackson joined. The Supreme Court on Friday barred the Biden administration from enforcing parts of a major regulation of sex discrimination in education that is embroiled in litigation over its protections for transgender students. Quote, on this limited record and its emergency applications, the government has not provided this court a sufficient basis to disturb the lower court's interim conclusions that the three provisions found likely to be unlawful are intertwined with and affect other provisions of the rule. Read the Supreme Court's opinion. The Supreme Court action does not affect states that did not challenge the regulation, and they will remain covered by the rule. So noting again, you don't play, you don't engage the process, no justice for you. Well, we see a split decision in this country now. How is it that the law meant one thing and only enforced in the rest of the states and not four states? That it continues. And so you're watching the slow destruction of objective basis right here in this report, even though they're holding back at this point, giving the lower court more time to try the case. So I have a link to the interim emergency decision in the broadcaster. If you want it, you'll read it for yourself. If you want, if you're so inclined to go through this, I find it important if we have a chance, one of the many aspects that we have, partly driven by what we did at Jefferson Mining District, was to engage these agencies that went off the rails, that stole the republic, stole private property, stole our right of production, encumbered us so much, and still do, even so. That is how I started to learn how the engagement can help. It's not the only answer, It wasn't the only thing we did. We probably had 10 things moving at once all the time. Is part of what I'm saying, find something you enjoy doing and then stick with it, because you may be one of the parts of the 10 moving things that have to happen. It would be very hard to pull all of this off as one, someone doing any of all of this. So engaging, you see the other states that didn't jump in did not have an opportunity to stop it if it's a violation. And I think it is when we see the definition why the benefits were extended and on what purpose. In other words, they're asking for special rights to be given instead of just relying on the rights that you would have in your biological sense, which are neutral also, if you think about that. What is this game that goes on? It seems like it's a mental decoupling. It's a mental deficiency. Look at me. Look at me. Now, I'm sure I don't know all the cases, and I'm sure that there might be somebody that takes offense to the conditions that they find, but those are not something of a national law concern. And I've found that a lot of the complaints can be reduced to other things that are in law already that give remedy as well. And I've also been on the other hand where you give special rights to people, you take them away from other people. You take those things from other people. So that wasn't a good answer either. We'll be looking at the Miguel Cardona, Secretary of Education et al., Tennessee et al., on application for stay is what you're looking for in the broadcaster. I'll put that title in. That's the decision that was rendered here. Again, read through it, see what it is, see what the courts are doing, see what the process is. I'm looking at this more. This LGBTQ is completely confusing to me. I don't know why special rights are given to anyone. I don't know how, in the last 10 years, special rights have been given to anyone relative to non-discrimination statutes. So this whole thing seems to be on its head to begin with for me. So I'm more interested in what's the process? How are people bringing this along? What are we looking at when we look at a bigger failure in the nation's processes and problems? What are we to be watching for? Because I may be one of the few that explain these administrative processes to give you standing to eventually go to a court, but you can stop things without having to go to court in the administrative side. That addresses your private life. You can do that with people. You don't know administration. You're administrating your life with someone you're in contention with. Then you start to learn how to develop your case before them. And if you provide the proper law, and they will find that they don't have it, so you're just not yelling at anybody, you just bring your authority. Now, I've done that a couple of times against people that encroached the mining claim, which I'm still trying to sell. I'm surprised at $2,500 an ounce, people don't want to get a mining claim. However, they tried to encroach that and found out that they were on the wrong side of the law really fast. I don't insult anybody. I just state the facts in the law. And they find themselves outside real quick. And that's what I learned from the process of addressing administrative issues and or the courts and or anybody, any official. It's the same thing. It's not that difficult. So one simple thing, when definitively needing to be taken behind the woodshed, is a corporate export of our right to speak and communicate freely and the importation of the highly communicable and destructive mind virus. As we hear, without that protection, where we don't want to give, as a society, special rights to certain people, we want to all have the same rights, kind of like that equal rights of extortion, but better, hopefully. We want to protect against that. Woke, Delta Airlines' top DEI official bans the use of the terms ladies and gentlemen. And this little story gave me an insight on maybe how to address some other questions I have. It's not really a question, actually. I don't really ask questions anymore. I think I've got it kind of handled. And so when we place things out, when we recouple, reassemble our mind back together, and we start thinking clearly, we start to understand when you take a certain path and you hold strictly to it, there's certain outcomes that come out that people that have they're mentally decoupled don't come to that sensible outcome, despite the path they've taken that path, showing you and proving you they're not really on the path. It's some other defect in them. And we're going to see that, I think, here as we run through and as we watch the federal government not being able to show that some people should have special rights because of their ideological preference to a gender identity. Now we can't say ladies and gentlemen, or we're going to be discouraged from saying so, at least on an aircraft. And this will spread around if it's given a chance. Over the last few years, Delta Airlines has embraced the diversity, equity, and inclusion agenda under the purview of a chief officer who believes that the phrase ladies and gentlemen isn't inclusive. Delta's chief diversity, equity, inclusion, and social impact officer, Kyra Lynn Johnson, has said publicly Delta is striving to, quote, boldly pursue equity, which has impacted every level of the company, from its hiring practices to the language it uses in the gate announcements. Quote, Delta encourages our people to use language that is inclusive of everyone, as our global customer base includes a broad range of diversity in culture, backgrounds, identity, and experiences, the spokesman said. But let's go back to that phrase they used. This is not boldly pursuing equity. It's pursuing corporate sustainable transformative abuse. When you think that that biological YY chromosome woman identifying as a man, or an XY biological male identifying as a woman, would be flattered to be respectfully referenced a lady or a gentleman as everyone else is addressed in public on a general sense, I'm sure that they would. When you go down that path and you are being referenced as a lady and a gentleman, whatever your identity, you're being respected like everybody is. And doing that, that's inclusive on this point as well. Those proper pronouns cause the division. Saying you're either a man or a woman, and ladies and gentlemen, we're not making any differentiation. Everybody who identifies as either sex should be feeling pretty respected right there. But these folks are not. So this lack of separation would all be embraced, I would think, if you were properly mentally coupled together. Unless this is an act by these people, or a mental illness, or a gross immaturity, it seems as well, as I see them respond, being a needy child, and an attention-getting pretense is what they're using here. Anyway, watching this story, it seemed to me, why wouldn't anybody who identified as a woman or a man, however they were biologically situated, why wouldn't they be feel respectfully represented by just the statement, ladies and gentlemen? I don't get that. So it seems that Delta Airlines is actually furthering and promoting abuse of everyone by entertaining this mental infirmity or underlying psychotic cause or this lack of maturity yet to recognize what basic good manners is, whatever gender that you are. That a genuine mature woman or man, however existing or conceived, would find being referenced a respectful lady or gentleman an insult is an insult. In my mind, Delta Airlines here, I think, needs to go the way of the Bud Light as well, because I don't think we need no stinking disrespect to genuine ladies and gentlemen. If you identify, you're an XY and you identify as a woman, you're a woman, you're a lady if you're acting like a lady. But I notice a lot of these folks don't act like a lady or a gentleman. And I don't know why. I wish they would. See, I come from a place where we're talking all this stuff. There was nobody when I was growing up, there was nobody that was any more than anybody else except for by your merit, by your achievement, and you respected those that actually showed the way on how they did it. Had nothing. I don't think my life has ever been looking at anybody relative to their gender or their gender identity at all, ever. And yet now it's a problem. And a gay friend of mine that I did work with, he explained a lot of this. I've told you this story before, and that community then was terrified of bringing this up and making it something, because they were perfectly fine at that time to be like everybody else. And that was an interesting insight. Why don't you just want to be like everybody else if you're normally man or a woman? So maybe Delta Airlines might reconsider in light of that a title 9 of the education amendments of the 1972 decision I just mentioned, what it's doing here. I feel that what they're doing is causing abuse and division in their statement saying that they're trying to make everything inclusive and non-divisive. And somebody else now, it's in the news, has just come up, he got a decision that hasn't been subjected to these geopolitical risks of the U.S. export and import controls that I was speaking of earlier, relative to Japan. A la Julian Assange, we have Kim.com is being mega uploaded to the U.S. for trial now. New Zealand has finally signed an extradition order after the Mega Upload founder's 12-year legal battle with the U.S. Kim.com is being extradited to the United States to face long-standing criminal charges related to the defunct file-sharing service Mega Upload. The order was signed by New Zealand Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith, according to Reuters, which said that the Mr.com should be surrendered to the U.S. to face trial. I found that statement very interesting. Mr.com should be surrendered to the U.S. Who's this judge talking to that's kept him captive? Very interesting. As the founder and former CEO of MegaUpload.com, born Kim Schmitz, was accused of U.S. authorities of having cost film studios a record and record companies over $500 million by enabling users to share pirated content. The German-born internet mogul moved to New Zealand in 2010 and has been fighting extradition since local police at the behest of the FBI in New Zealand raided his Auckland mansion in 2012 over charges of racketeering, money laundering, and copyright infringement. The Department of Justice shut down Mega Upload that same year. .com, who had spent the last several years pushing various conspiracy theories and digital disinformation, responded to the deportation ruling on X, saying, quote, "The obedient U.S. colony in the South Pacific just decided to extradite me for what users uploaded to Mega Upload unsolicited." Now, I use this link from The Verge as it's a biased view from what I can tell, as you can tell, talking about his conspiracy theories. Let's get down to what Kim.com just states there. He's being charged for crimes for content that was uploaded by users, but he did not solicit. And so understand what the real story here relative to the internet here. Whatever my sense of Kim.com, whatever my sense of what I've heard, the goings-on and transcripts of things, is not really what I'm really interested in. I've never been interested in any of that, actually, relative to what they're attacking him on. And they started attacking him after he started to support WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And so there's a lot of that, what they call like lawfare now, going on relative to being legal weapons that are taken against people. Two former Mega Upload officers, Matthias Ortman and Bram van der Kalk, were handed 31 and 30-month prison sentences, respectively, last year after signing a plea deal to avoid extradition. And in response to one of the tweets from Kim, before I had Kim's repost of the WikiLeaks X Twitter announcement of the New Zealand court, which I'll use as my lead, there's another response. And I also know now that there's been an update, so maybe I'm going to back off just a bit. But Cliff High responds to that post from WikiLeaks that was reposted by Kim.com. And I'm more interested in the jurisdiction, the authorities, whether or not they're acting right, limited government, whether or not they're expansive. FBI going to New Zealand? Understand that Kim.com has never been to the United States, just like Julian Assange. And so there's a more horrendous thing going on relative to these cases. Kim.com is also highly critical, extremely critical of Biden. And so part of this, you'll see, part of this is Biden essentially hiring an attorney to team up with the record companies and the movie companies to go after Kim.com. So there's a whole lot going on here that has nothing to do really with charges, but what governments will do to come after people, which I've been highly interested in, because that's how I got started in all this. The government started coming after me, and I was nobody. I figured if they come after me and I'm nobody, where did America go? There's no protections. I better bone up on this stuff. Well, here we are, over 3 decades later. I've got some insight. Well, Cliff High comes up. Now, I'm not going to underwrite all that. I'm just saying this is the things that you start to think about. And some of the things that I didn't understand why Kim.com's attorneys didn't bring it up, or partly so. And I know some of it is dismissive, or you can dismiss this, or the quality could be with what he says, but it's nevertheless, it's important to hear it. And so I want to read from Cliff High relative to his response. Now, he's concerned of this. And so Cliff High responds, "So if one is involved with the U.S. courts, it can seriously alter the situation to demand the bona fides of the court officers in the court itself. Okay, so I've talked to you about this. It's right in the code, too. None of this that I've talked about relative to that is not written down, that you couldn't go find it, and some of you did. So I'm going to go on with something that's maybe less strong, but still there to do. You will find that none have the required oaths of office, nor the required bonds. It varies by jurisdiction. Even states like Washington, which claims a collective bond on all state employees, has no court that can produce the proof of that bond, nor its terms and conditions, nor its guaranteeing party. And so along those lines is what I wanted to, and I might begin with, whether Kim.com does this or not, he needs to continue his challenges. Anybody in this condition needs to continue your challenges against the jurisdiction and authority of the U.S. courts. And anybody that's listened to me any length of time, you know, you should be knowing right where I'm going with this. This has never been brought up. Even Cliff High, he just barely touches it, but he touches it as a, I'll just tell you the way he wrote that. The bona fides are not what I'm going to mention, but they do talk about the incompetence of these, what we are told are judges. And we also have a quality of jurisdiction and an establishment authority that doesn't necessarily exist that they keep promoting for us. That Kim.com, and I'd like to see someone do this, why Kim.com is specially placed to be able to do this, if his attorneys would. So whether or not he does it, there's a challenge. It always needs to be made against jurisdiction and authority if you know where it might be. And so he actually needs to return to the New Zealand court. At the time I was thinking of this, I just read this morning, the court gave him an opportunity to respond, and that's due process, so that made sense. It isn't that he's being shipped out right now. So what I'm saying now could actually help him to return to the New Zealand court, or the judge that just made this decision, and put the things I would suggest needs to be put in, and look at what Cliff High has brought up, because they're all relevant to me as a challenge to show or to require, actually, the court or the government of the United States to prove jurisdiction, authority, and competence is going to be guaranteed to Kim.com, and I'm saying anybody in this capacity, in this problem. So go back to that court, that judge, which gave him the opportunity I now found out, and challenge that the United States didn't, and the judge who was required to find jurisdiction didn't find the U.S. ever produced its lawful jurisdiction, or that it could try an Article III case in its district courts before an Article III judge. So some of you that have been listening to me, I hope you anticipated this is exactly where we're going to go. And this is not an opinion. This is just going to be do the black and white. Yes, the Title 28 study between Section 81 or so to 133, yeah, it takes 3 to 7 days. It took me 7 days. And the reason why it takes people less is because I explained what to be looking for. But I had to work out how this works, how this thing is. 3 to 7 days to find the jurisdictions of any district court. And then you find out there are two, remember? And those of you who did the study found that. And so you have to challenge whether or not there's jurisdiction, whether or not the district courts are valid, what validity they are, and are they on land exclusively ceded to the United States? That's relative to venue. All this is straight up challengeable, and it can't be proven by the government whatsoever. Whatever the discussion of oaths were, they kind of destroyed that argument. Why I'm not too thrilled about it. You can still bring it up, and I'm not saying not to. But it's more important to show that the New Zealand judge failed to find whether or not he could find jurisdiction could be had so they could give him a fair trial at all in a place competent to do so. Now, and I don't intend to exhaust this pre-plea avoidance here. That's what we're talking about. But I want you to all recall that those of you that did that study, and we explained that title through Title 20 in the U.S. Code, it explained that there are two district courts of different jurisdiction and establishment. And then I pointed you over to back that up so you could see you're not on this just a useless goose chase. Go to Wiki and you look under district courts, and I can't remember exactly what the heading is. There's two of them. One of them is the more important one. The Wikipedia explains there are two district courts. And I'll give you the punchline to get you along a little quicker, because I didn't have this originally until I figured it out. But one is a legislatively established district court identified as the USDC, United States District Court. Get the order of the letters correct and you'll start to be able to figure this out. That's another clue that I didn't have. And on the other district court is a constitutionally established district court designated DCUS. And that would be for Kim, a pre-plea remedy in avoidance. As to the jurisdiction of a USDC court, he has likely been deemed to be extradited too. Because I don't see any DC US courts functioning at this point. They're all USDC courts. But he has to do that prior pre-plea to, in a pre-plea remedy in avoidance before he makes a plea into the US court. He can do that before this New Zealand judge at this point, who asked him to respond. And he needs to. The USDC legislative court is likely not a court of competent jurisdiction over that subject matter. It's only actually under the legislative territories. That's what you heard Julian Assange go to. I talked about this already with Julian Assange. It's really a simple thing. You didn't hear anything about this, which he should have. I say should, guardedly, because he needed to get out. That's a, may have put him back in jail. And so I don't understand it. There's going to be maybe a consequence. But right now, Kim.com is running around. He's got a judge he's talking to. He can direct, his attorneys can direct that these checks be done. And I know that the United States government did not put in the record any of these things. And that was their burden. And so this thing should have died a long time ago. That judge shows you he's in the pocket of the United States government. He should have found this already. And so the judges are supposed to know the law, right? Not wait for some guy behind the woodshed to figure it out or one of his listeners. Or somebody in Washington called Cliff High. Another challenge I've offered as well is against both the magistrate judge and the senior judge. So these officials are deemed judges. You don't argue that they're not judges. They're deemed judges. In the law, they're deemed judges. But they're not Article III competent. A legislative court is not an Article III competent court. The Constitution is where we're speaking. Congress creates a legislative court. They have different capacities. The magistrate here may be a judge, but it's not Article III. The magistrate has never accepted a commission to a judgeship through the due process required. And the senior judge has retired that Article III commission. It's no longer functioning. They're like administrative clerks, but they're not Article III competent. Even if they were in an Article III court. And those are not necessarily available, as I've done some tests and can't find one. I think I know where one is, but it's not at the district court level. And this is the other thing you start to find. What happened to our court system? And there are many of these challenges that which should be made. And I'm only going to, again, you see, I'm not talking about all that they're charging with or the copyright violations. This was always a bigger deal. This was always a bigger issue relative to our justice system and exposing it. And people like Kim.com are in a position to be able to or get the answer that may be denied to us. These courts are without jurisdiction, competency, or authority, or lawful power. And when that is the case, their decisions and acts are void. Their existence is void. And if acting under the color of a void power, then that's felonies, as I've explained, whether by extortion or coercion. I know, the equal right and enjoyment of extortions of every kind and no to no other notwithstanding. That's not what we're talking about here, because this is about whether or not you have a power to hear and determine. And they lose on every aspect when they're aid of their legislative court. And the judges isn't Article III competent. And even those judges may have problems, but I won't go that far. Like I said, I can't get everything. But for our purposes here, forget about the equal rights of the enjoying extortion. When they act under color of an authority, they are committing felony extortion and coercion wherever they sit, whatever state they sit in. And remember, I said that their land is typically, in a court, is not ceded to the federal government. It's state land they rent. These are not federal properties at all, either. And you start to put that together, start working it. What does that make them? And you start coming up with a different establishment in this country right now. Like I call it post-founding father era Lincolnization. So the point of all this is there's a much higher bar that the government was required to meet that Kim.com must bring, or as Cliff High stated, if you don't ask, they don't tell. So to that point, I agree with Cliff High, and I appreciate that he even brought that forward. So I bring this stuff forward and no one responds. And nobody. Zero. But here he brings it up, so he's opened the little door a little bit. I now see that the attorneys can respond to the judge, for Kim.com. I may or may not approach that. I may do something yet. But that's what he can do right now. And anybody who's in the position and anybody who gets subjected to a court can do this as well. And I'm not saying you win. It's not a silver bullet, but you at least get on the record what's going on. And I'll suggest the Supreme Court has its own section in code, and it turns into an Article 3 court on its own. Again, like I said, there's only one court I found in the country that has Article 3 competency, but it's not called a district court, and it's supposed to. And so I can't go through all of it. Something's happened in this country, and people don't quite pay attention to it. But Kim is in a good position to have put it forward, as Julian Assange would. And Kim.com is even better position because he doesn't really be he's not in protection or locked up. He's free. So he can spend his time with his family and do all these things that take time to render. So he's in a little better position here. And while I wouldn't describe it as an ask necessarily, as Cliff High might have described it, it's imperative to assert these challenges to the void power or tyranny will reign as we watch, as we see these injustices and the justice system build up. You don't challenge these void powers, tyranny reigns, and it's done. And people, that's where they shrug their shoulders and they have nothing more to say. Why do you fight the system and what all this other stuff comes about? So we got to be very careful on how much we give up. And maybe some of it was because we stopped when we should have kept going. This is a BKWRLM 590. But speaking of abject tyranny raining bombs, at least 100 killed, dozens injured in an Israeli strike on a Gaza City school. At least 100 people were killed and dozens others wounded in Israeli bombing of a school in an Al-Daraj neighborhood in central Gaza City, Press TV reported. The Israeli Defense Forces confirmed it carried out an airstrike on a school in Gaza City. The IDF said that prior to the strike, numerous steps were taken to mitigate the risk of harming civilians, including the use of precise munitions, aerial surveillance, and intelligence information. Now, the Zionist Federation Movement murders, being illegal belligerent occupiers pursuant to international law, they do not have a right of self-defense. I'm going to keep repeating this because it doesn't seem to come up too much. But that's the law. That's what's supposed to be happening, that everybody's allowing. And they do not have a right to claim measures taken to mitigate civilian harms, no matter how precise they are. On top of that, I don't think I've seen proof of the Zionists' claim if it had the right, either. You know, being able here to precisely kill people during their dawn prayer at school isn't an excuse allowing the massacre of a people in a school anyway. We can listen to the press, or we can start pressing the law and the objective basis, not get into ideological mind decoupling. The Israeli strikes targeted the displaced people while performing fajr, it's dawn prayer. The matter led to rapid increase in the number of casualties, the government media office in Gaza said. The media office stressed that the Israeli attack comes within the framework of a crime of genocide and ethnic cleansing against our Palestinian people in a clear manner. The statement added that due to a horror of the massacre and the large number of martyrs, the medical crews, civil defense, relief, and emergency teams have not been able to retrieve bodies of all the martyrs so far. Israel has also been enforcing a crippling siege on the coast of the territory by choking off the flow of foodstuffs, medicine, electricity, and water into the Palestinian territory. And all the verbal global condemnation means nothing here as we read all this stuff nowadays. The inaction to stop the Zionist genocide is causing everyone, these countries, to be accessory and complicit with the genocide, or the lesser evils directed by Satan Yehu and his other irreligious anti-Semites. Now, why do I say all that? If you go look at what's going on, the Palestinians are Semites. Satan Yehu is not religious. He is also a political movement. It's not religion. It's not a people that came from a place that has the definition of what a Semite is. the Palestinians are and do. But being Captain Obvious, merely saying that there is no justification for the massacres is not enough. And the ICJ decision against the Zionist Federation Movement operating under color of State of Israel confirms what I've been saying all along about all this. Again, as I read that, I've said it on the record, and then the ICJ came up, 15 judges looking at the facts, came up with this. All they did is they came up with international law. This is not hard to figure out. It has no ideological bent. It's not biased. It's just what man has figured out what to do amongst man and all the horrors that man will do to man. That's Cain killed Abel. And it's obvious from the beginning, we don't have to be told then, I guess is the point here. As part of this theme today is that we just look and see the objective basis. We don't have to listen to these mentally decoupled people for whatever reason they are that way. I mean, I start feeling, like I said, it's an abuse. I feel sorry for that they're there, but they can't rule our lives anymore and be allowed to rule our lives. They can't have special rights relative to them. If there's categories that need to be made, they need to be made and then made fairly treated. And that's not typically what government's good at doing either as well, unless it's to extort from everybody equally as a civil right, as you see. They do that everywhere. And there's an obligation for nations and non-government organizations to do something to arrest this self-evident crime. But not just more talk about it, or about how horrific it is. So you're horrified. Okay. And you're horrified. And that's all we hear. How horrific it is. I ask, and ICJ said, do something. So as an example of how fast our counterforces amassed to stop an extremist lone wolf mass shooter is what none of these feckless nations is doing for the Palestinians that they will do to their own people. We see what people and police will do to mass shooters is not what's going on in the global states relative to Gaza. And it ought to. The law, the objective basis, our morality is dependent upon this response. And it was interesting in this link I'll give you the questions inspired by the comments section. To compare Jews and Nazis is to make them look more human. When did the Nazis bomb schools, humanitarian shelters, refugee camps, and hospitals full of women and children? When did the Nazis massacre doctors and their patients for no apparent reasons? When did the Nazis deny women and children food and water? Worse, the Nazis never burned children alive in refugee tents. Anyone who tells you that Jews are humans, she is lying. Jews are savage dogs with loaded guns. Netanyahu is just one savage dog with a loaded gun in a school for unarmed children. According to Dr. Mark Perlmutter, an American surgeon in Gaza, in just a couple of weeks, he saw more carnage inflicted upon civilians than he had in the combined total of his previous 30 years of humanitarian visits to war zones around the world. In particular, it was obvious that Israeli snipers were deliberately shooting young Palestinian children and toddlers, aiming precision shots at their hearts and at their heads. This is the psychopathic savage Jews that America is defending. International organizations have reported that some 500 doctors and nurses in Gaza have already been killed, while another 300 are still being held in Israeli prisons. A Harvard student warned that to call Jews savage dogs is an insult to all dogs. This was posted by Ali Ali. The rights groups to find no evidence in that issue, in that event, of military presence, as Israeli government stated when it bombed that school. An initial investigation by the Geneva-based Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor has found no evidence of a military presence at the site of the Al-Dabin school massacre in Gaza that killed more than 120 people. According to all the available information, the testimonies that there were no military gatherings or command centers at the school, and it was never used for military objectives. Survivors testified that the school was providing shelter to hundreds of children whose families felt safe there, the Euromed said on Sunday. Quote, the narrow layout of the school and the lack of launch pads and shelters would make it impossible for the site to be used for military operations. The building's cramped layout and tight spaces make it unsuitable for military operations that call for planning and logistical assistance, the group said. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad group denied Israeli claims Sunday about the presence of resistance fighters in the school. Quote, we categorically deny the enemy's allegations that there were armed men inside the school, the Palestinian resistance group said in a brief statement. Quote, these lies promoted by the enemy aim to sow confusion and escape accountability as it continues its war of extermination against our people intending to kill as many as possible, it said. Hamas resistance movement has also denounced the Israeli claims as, quote, an attempt to justify its heinous crimes. Understand, I'm going to interject. ICJ says that these folks need to be stopped. So just talking about it ain't good enough. The Israeli regime has frequently used the allegation as a pretext to attack civilian buildings in Gaza, including hospitals and schools. Hamas deputy chief in Gaza, Khalil al-Hayya, said that the Israeli attack on the school was another indication that the occupying regime was trying to wipe the Palestinians out of Gaza. Iran and several other nations have already strongly condemned the barbaric Israeli airstrike on the schools in Gaza housing displaced Palestinians. Iran's foreign minister spokesman Nasser Kanaani said that in remarks on Sunday, as the mass killing of Palestinians has revealed the terrorist nature of the Zionist regime, the true face of its inhumane supporters, and the falsehood of the U.S. human rights slogans. He emphasized that the regime's escalating brutality shows its fear of collapse, and this becomes a very important story that's developing right now, like a wounded animal, a caged animal, a cornered animal coming out, and it's going down. It's going down fast and hard. As I mentioned, economically, they're not doing very good, but for the United States, Israel doesn't exist. And then you find out that in a reverse fashion, the undue influence of the Zionist political movement in the United States Knesset then funds this, which is actually the United States government needing to have that little foothold in there to do the rest of what it wants to do in the Middle East, which is all not good. We're getting in foreign entanglements where we shouldn't actually be. We have internal influence, AIPAC, the leading Israeli lobby group, and its role in subversion of the U.S. democracy. The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, is the most famous and equally notorious Israeli lobby group in the world. But how important is it really? In it, David Wearing presents his arguments in these words. AIPAC may best be seen as performing a disciplinary function within U.S. politics. One can certainly argue that the U.S. support for Israel is made somewhat firmer given AIPAC's role, and these marginal factors matter, but they are still marginal. Certainly, the Zionist movement is keen to downplay its influence about a report in the tablet, How Influential is AIPAC, Less Than Beer Sellers, Public Accountants, and Toyota states, the way AIPAC is talked about, you'd think they'd be a lobbying juggernaut, surely one of the largest in the nation's capital. Wrong. Between 1998 and 2018, AIPAC didn't make a dent in the Center for Responsive Politics list of the top spending lobbying groups. In 2018, the total of pro-Israel lobbying spending was about $5 million, of which AIPAC accounted for $3.5 million. In contrast, Native American casinos spent about $22 million that year. By the tablet's count, AIPAC was the 147th highest ranking entity in terms of lobbying spending in 2018. This is an attempt to pretend that the influence of the Zionist movement is much less than suggested by observers. Listen carefully. However, against that, we can present these facts. Taking the figure disclosed by the lobbying regulators as if that was all AIPAC spends on lobbying is profoundly mistaken. Though it has disclosed only $2.7 million lobbying expenditures in 2022, its actual expenditure was $79.1 million. In addition, AIPAC controls another nonprofit, the American Israel Education Foundation. It discloses nothing to the regulator, yet had a 2,222 expenditure of the further $44.6 million. When we add campaign contributions, the figures rise significantly. Donations by AIPAC's Political Action Committee, PAC for short, and its new super PAC, the United Democracy Project, in the most recent period of 2024 totals $17.4 million and $31.5 million respectively. It's worth noting that none of this was donated by AIPAC itself. These are additional donations it has raised from others. The United Democracy Project is the third largest super PAC and the U.S. in terms of 2024 expenditure, according to Open Secrets, the U.S. lobby watchdog. This easily outstrips all corporate-related super PACs. Taking figures the lobby narrowly conceived are woefully inadequate, as it does not include money spent by Israeli firms or by foreign agents registered with the United States Federal Government Foreign Agents Registration Act Office. $6.3 million was spent in 2022 by Israeli firms, including arms firms Elbit at $770,000, Rafael at $680,000, Israel Aerospace Industries at $446,000, and a phone hacking firm, Celebrite, at $440,000. $16 million in the same year was spent by registered foreign agents of Israel, including the regime itself, the World Zionist Organization, $4.2 million, the Jewish Agency, $9.5 million, and the phone hacking firm NSO Group, $1.5 million. But even that pales in comparison to data compiled by the IsraelLobby.org website. It correlates data on Zionist groups providing subsidies to the Zionist entity, including illegal settlements and the occupation forces and lobbying education. Let me interject quickly here. The Zionist settlement forces are actually antagonistic to part of the government. They're actually a strong arm group, organized criminals that are used to counter any, that can be used to counter any the government action, and those were the ones that were used in the prisons to release those soldiers that then declared that Israel, the most moral army in the world, could rape prisoners and do whatever, everything that they wanted to them. This article here, again, it shows that the annual budget of $3.6 billion, as long as ago as 2012, rising to an estimated $6.3 billion in 2020. These figures do not include the data above on Israel firms or foreign agents. There is hardly any research on the depth and extent of the Zionist penetration of United States society, which is cognizant in this data. It's time to dig deeper and reveal the actual spending power and reach of the lobby. Turning to back to AIPAC, it has a deserved reputation as the most powerful Israeli lobby group in the United States. However, a key Zionist talking point is that the claim that it is not so powerful. AIPAC was created by Isaiah Kennan, the contractor from the Zionist regime, in 1963. It was originally called the American Zionist Council. 2 months after the American Zionist Council was ordered to register as a foreign agent, Kennan incorporated AIPAC, which did not register as a foreign agent, though it is. Recently, an unredacted tax filing in 2019 was obtained by The Intercept. It revealed that the financiers are a clutch of large foundations and nonprofits, such of which are family-run, which also offer funds to other genocidal Zionist groups. In the spring of this year, it was revealed that the AIPAC had a $100 million war chest for the upcoming election cycle. Election tampering much? Not under American law, apparently. AIPAC Super PAC is amusingly named United Democracy Project. It spends targeted funds on lawmakers who challenge any pro-Israel policy, including the mildly critical squad of Democratic representatives and also libertarian Republicans such as Thomas Massie, who has voted against military aid to Israel. It was Massie who revealed in an interview with Tucker Carlson that AIPAC appoints handlers for each congressperson. Here is his description. Quote, it's like your babysitter, your AIPAC babysitter who is always talking to you for AIPAC. They're probably a constituent in your district, but they are, you know, firmly embedded with AIPAC. AIPAC is part of a complex network of lobby groups which collectively can be described as the Israel lobby. Further, the lobbying is itself only smallish part of the much larger Zionist movement. It is this which needs to be asserted in all of its complexity. When we do that, a more rounded and complex account emerges. The role of AIPAC cannot be considered outside its role in the wider movement because its activities include fundraising and deploying them through other groups and organizations are a core element of this strategy. Reducing AIPAC to its lobbying and disclosure expenditure or its total budget cannot capture its significance in the movement, let alone the significance of the Zionist movement in total. Hence, AIPAC and the rest of the Zionist movement must be stopped. It was also reported that Israel promote and compromise congresscutters as a group have received at least $175,000 each from the Zionist lobby and the undue campaign influencing AIPAC as we look through that. So minimum entry is if you're a congressman supporting him, you're going to have $175,000 minimum handed to you somehow. But here we're moving on with this and the undue political and campaign or election tampering influence on all this. Democracy and its discontents pro-Israel lobby overrides U.S. public opinion on Gaza. Remember, we talk cognitive warfare and all these things. The money that's poured into this is phenomenal to keep this condition going and apparently keeps the world paralyzed from acting against its better nature. I would hope it's a better nature. To stop genocide or war crimes or the massive killing of people that actually deserve to be in the land. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has often publicly waded into U.S. politics, perhaps most famously in 2015 when he gave a speech to the session of the United States Congress denouncing former President Barack Obama's Iran nuclear deal. Quote, Israel has crossed all and everyone's red lines, Kavanaugh wrote in a recent piece published on the website The Polemicist. Israel is telling the world it will kill anyone and any number of people anywhere at any time of its choosing, and it does not give a damn about what anyone in the world thinks about it. It is acting with complete contemptuous disregard of international law, conventions, and common morality, certainly of the people and nations it considers its adversaries and of the countries of whose supports it depends, says the independent journalist Jim Kavanaugh. Israel is only slightly less contemptuous of Americans than the Palestinians, a journalist claimed, noting that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's skill in manipulating the United States to serve his interests, quote, Palestinians they consider subhuman and dispensable persons versus Americans they consider necessary fools whom they have to pretend they're interested in ceasefires and two-state solutions for because Americans are stupid enough to believe it. Well, you know, behind the woodshed, I was saying there's no two-state solution. So we look right back at the documents and state objective, and this guy can't do this to any of us. We're not so persuaded. Quote, they just got to keep the Americans around because the Americans are their patrons, he continued. The United States of America is the indispensable patron of Israel. They could not do anything that they're doing without it, and we are completely complicit in it. The longtime Israeli Prime Minister once claimed the United States is, quote, a thing you can move very easily, Vince, very easily, in private comments secretly recorded in 2001. Quote, the American people don't back this move, said host Wilmer Leon of the United States, lockstep support for Israel, most recently demonstrated by the approval of a $4.7 billion in funding for the country. Quote, when you look at the numbers and the particulars as we are in the 2024 presidential season, some think that the candidates would be listening to the electorate. But this is one of the issues that as it relates to those in elected positions, or our elected representatives, they're not listening. It's not a democracy. It's an oligarchy, insisted Kavanaugh. The donor class gets what it wants. Well, people are seeing what Zionism is, and they don't really want to go to war for it, he continued, noting the ample evidence of apparent Israeli war crimes easily found on social media. Quote, they were tired of the forever wars anyway. Everybody knew all of this, and what we did to Libya and Iraq and Syria was all baloney. There was nothing democratic about it. I hope people are noticing. I hope they start to shout out and do things that they can to take care of this thing, make it right. You know, if the governments aren't going to make it right, the non-governmental organizations aren't making it right, it's up to people all over the place to make it right. And override this lobby does. Override it does. The U.S. approves not $4 billion, $18 billion in sales of 50 F-15IA aircraft to Israel to go bomb the innocent children and women men of Palestine. The government of Israel has requested to buy, and the Secretary of State has approved a foreign military sale of F-15IAs and F-15I plus aircraft and related equipment for an estimated $18.82 billion, the agency released. But that's not all. The Israeli government has also requested a purchase of 25 modification kits for the existing F-15I multi-role fighters, 120 F-10 GE 129 engines, 90 advanced display core processor 2s, 320 LAU 128 advanced medium-range air-to-air missile launchers, 25 M61 Vulcan cannons, and 180 embedded global positioning system inertial navigation systems, among other related equipment, according to the release. But that's not all. It's going to so-called buy, and the blinking idiot, the accessory to the torture and murder of American journalist Gonzalo Lira, has approved a $102 million sale of 30 AIM 120 C8 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles and related equipment to the government of Israel, the DSSCA announced. And that's not all for these specially chosen psychopaths. Furthermore, the U.S. State Department approved $61 million of 50,120-millimeter high-explosive mortar cartridges to Israel, the agency revealed, and were not done giving to the fallen yet. In addition, the U.S. State Department has approved a potential $774 million sale of 120-millimeter tank cartridge and related equipment to Israel to the agency, the agency said. Yet there is more. The grifters that keep on grifting. The U.S. State Department has also approved a $583 million sale of M11-480A1M2 tactical vehicles to Israel, the DSCA announced. I thought about this was, isn't the buying of American fighter jets and all of this other military hardware being bought with American welfare funds to Israel, and this is not actually a sale at all? That at best, it's the straw man sale funded by the United States compromised Congress rodents who infest and plague the ship of state to perpetuate the genocide or other despicable acts upon the Semitic and other people of Palestine and to make war in the greater region. So we're now to understand a U.S. military-industrial public-private partnership is buying its own products through middlemen to fight the Arabs directly through the state of Is Zionism mercenaries. Do I have that about right? Are people following this? Or is this just another money laundering scheme, just like Ukraine? Or as we can find being reported that Israel's support for Azerbaijan and Karabakh conflict has been known. In Tel Aviv, they sold weapons worth billions of dollars to the Azerbaijanis, and the Israeli intelligence and military played a key role in planning and approving the operation in Artsakh. In addition to the commercial interests of the Israelis in supporting Azerbaijan arms sales and oil production. Where are they getting these arms, folks? The opportunity to approach the borders of Iran through Artsakh played a key role. Where does the state of Zionism get the weapons and funds to exist and perpetrate the war on the world but from the United States government and the domestic foreign enemies from within? Right, Blinken? because the United States is a thing you can move very easily, Vince, very easily, and laundering. Or is it both? Because I don't see a shred of law and order working here, and who is going to operate all those advanced weapon systems needing 8 months to a year of special training, or to fly all those newfangled jets immediately if it takes at least 2 years of training to become combat ready? Will it be your currently trained American sons and daughters, your husbands and wives? And even if not, if the straw man mercenary state of is Zionists can do it, did you want that money being used to commit genocide in your name and for no good reason for the military-industrial complex to profit from the pretense? I would hope my listener would say no. And if so, if you believe this nation is a great nation of laws and justice, but don't laugh, what do you intend is what I'm saying here? Who are these government officials working for that protect the state of is Zionism, Satan Yehu, approving is Zionists' massacres to maintain a failing world hegemony? 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 Hegemony. There you go. For those of us syllabically challenged. Because clearly it isn't you they represent with all of this democracy, despite that you pay their bills at your expense, and increasingly so, proven by your increasing oppressive economic hardships. Further proven that, in the day, for 3% tax on tea, that was dumped in the bay, while today, at more than 60% aggregated tax, that the delusional free people are silent. It is said that a people get the government they deserve. At some point, if you deserve better, much better, I would hope, you're going to have to act to counter this machine before it grinds you up. I've been advocating for everyone to get behind a woodshed now. Get behind a woodshed now. And if not that, then what is your alternative to avoid this global meat grinder? As they've set this thing up so perfectly, brings us in, and we just go along with it. And I'm saying generally. Yeah, there's some of us that complain. But at some point, really, rubber has to meet the ground. It has to hit the surface, and it has to gain traction. As the Unit Party approves of more for genocide, we can watch the developing grunge match. Musk offers interview to Kamala Harris. And look at the theater going on with all this. The billionaire extended the invitation after speaking at length with former U.S. President Donald Trump. And how was that Trump interview promoted, folks? Let's jump to the punchline of the dancing, boxing, and grappling extravaganza. The ex-owner promised a highly entertaining conversation with the former U.S. president. The interview with Trump was hailed by his campaign as the interview of the century. That sounds like promoting a wrestling match, don't it, Hulk? But that's not the punchline here. At the end of the interview, Musk reiterated his endorsement of Donald Trump and described him as the path to prosperity. Now, everyone behind the woodshed knows what prosperity is. No, not your dictionary, what the world agenda is coming on. Musk is a humanist. Trump promotes democracy. Doesn't want to keep the republic. Democracy. Remember the war against us. So I've just recently spoken about that big tech technocratic quantum leap to support Trump, of which Musk is a part, as well as Trump's recent embrace of trackable, traceable, programmable digital token currency. What Russia is already doing, as I've just recently reported. With the path to prosperity, they're promoting shared responsibility to the sustainable development goals. With its direct democracy and perpetual endless debt and obligations or token citizenship. You heard this all described in Agenda 2030. I took two episodes, I believe, if I remember correctly, two full episodes to read that UN document to you so that there would be no confusion of the future we are walking into without any resistance and with your consent. The path to prosperity is the transformation of your country to endless debt of third-party obligation. Well, you just heard what the third party kind of screwed up your Social Security account when you started talking this episode, didn't you? The third-party obligation to the prosperity that they want. Go read Agenda 2030. It's written. Three-quarters of the way down, you see your endless obligations of debt by the Sustainable Development Goals. Now, under the pretense of protecting Gaia through the green religion, an ideology, a mind-decoupled ideology. And if these two don't know this, it's worse. They are dumber than Kamala. Dumb. They're the dumbester. And Kamala brings no other cause or reason for being than these two, merely on a different path. Some call it being a Marxist. It's not. It's worse. It's way worse. It's so many more facets coming together. That is one of the facets of it. Now, so in an interview that we see with the humanist Musk, with the Green Queen coming here, is merely a second promotion for the same societal destruction, as I've been explaining for over a decade in its various iterations. If you've been listening, you've heard all this. Keep pulling it together. None of these change agents, not Trump, Kamala, or Musk, will work to keep the Republic. None of them. And you don't hear anything about that coming out of them. And anyone that doesn't think so had better pull that ring out of their nose, if not their entire head from someplace else, guiding their oblivion, because there can't be any worth in their validity to the lot of these. There is nothing that we can use that's coming out of any of these guys. That said, the lesserest of the evils, we would have to see Trump. But that's not going to end up working, even if he was the good guy. Unless he's dumberist. Unless he's really dumberist. He's only going to last 4 years anyway. But with this cage match, this grunge match, I wonder how Kamala, mean Harris, will look doing a mean Mustafa Ali's reverse 450 slash off the ex-Twitter top rope. It is her interview with Musk. Be really interesting and entertaining, won't it? And those of us with a vested interest from the peanut gallery in the federal race, the decision of the Ninth Circuit provides clarity about the citizenship and voter registration in Arizona. Arizona won't be able to block those who sign up to vote using a federal registration form from casting a ballot in the presidential race, at least not now. In a brief order Thursday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected a plea by the Republican legislative leaders to delay the ruling by a trial judge that barring the enforcement of such a ban. In the same order, the three-judge panel also said that using the federal form still can cast their ballots by mail. What the judges decided, however, is that anyone who tries to register to vote using a state form is required to, at the same time, to provide documented proof of citizenship. More to the point, if they do not, the application must be rejected. That overturns what has been occurring. Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer said that the practice until now has been that the registration requests using the state form that did not also have a proof of citizenship automatically were put into the federal-only category as if the applicants had submitted a federal form. Richer said he and the other 19 county recorders will stop doing that. But Richard noted none of this disturbs the ability of those who use the federal form in the first place to be able to cast a ballot in the presidential race. Several rights groups filed suit calling the requirements a baseless assault on Arizona's election system based on a conspiracy theory that the non-citizens are voting despite the persistent lack of credible evidence to support such claims. Bolton agreed, but Thursday, order from the Ninth Circuit allows Arizona to enforce a proof of citizen requirement for those who try to register using the state form. The federal form, however, presents an entirely different issue, and the key is the National Voter Registration Act, which requires states to accept and use a registration form prepared by the Federal Elections Assistance Commission, and form that requires only that the applicants avow under penalty of perjury that they are a U.S. citizen. I've said this before. That's all it requires. You just avow that you are. That's it. You're presumed telling the truth. The plain language of the National Voter Registration Act reflects an intent to regulate all elections for federal office, including the president and vice president. That's the limit of it right there, as I've been saying. Bolton wrote last year in the enjoining the state from enforcing the provisions while the case plays out, and quote, and binding precedent indicates that Congress has the power to control registration for presidential elections. So how is shall not be infringed, not the plain language of the U.S. Constitution applicable to the states pursuant to the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, that anything about the right to keep and bear arms and acquire arms continues to be a question in the states or the federal government? We're going to go on that little decision. Why don't we just apply that to the Second Amendment? But you see here, it's people not understanding how this place is gone and wired. And the judge came back and said, yeah, no, there's a federal side of this and there's a state side. And you're going to have to be strictly compliant with the state side if you're a state citizen. How's that? Interesting. And relative to the PETA gallery thinking, the vote for president and vice president in electoral college system to make more sure that they will have a candidate by then, Trump will have to have a bulletproof shield around him and the podium for outdoor rallies. The U.S. Secret Service will install a bulletproof glass shield around former President Donald Trump's podium for outdoor campaigns and rallies. This measure is usually reserved to U.S. presidents serving in office, but the U.S. Secret Service is making an exception in light of the attempted assassination of Trump when he did. Okay, great. Well, what I suggested should happen for every candidate after that Trump stunt, and I was wondering why it wasn't even brought up initially, and why didn't the Secret Service use foldable ballistic shields to protect Trump before that instead of merely using their bodies thrown on top of him? Why wasn't that an idea? Now that the candidate is protected, can we enjoy our right to bear arms at these rallies, please? That was my first objection to the shooter thing, if you remember. I hope something I said gets you thinking, gets you looking, gets you applying, most importantly, and for you, in all the things that you need. And this has been BTWRLM 590, and I'll be with you next week. Tech Diffs for Nature World.
Echoes call, the hour is near. Behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three. Hal's voice rolls like thunder, fierce and free. Pull up a chair, lean in close. Lessons to learn, dose by dose. Behind the woodshed, no stone unturned. Hal's words ignite, the airwaves burn. Stand up, listen, it's time to learn. Behind the woodshed, where truths are earned. Law to liberty, the spectrum line. In house court, no place to hide. A can of wood fast, ready to burst for unspoken truths and unquenchable thirst. Behind the woodshed, no stone unturned. House words ignite, the airwaves burn.
Still reigns in house words, freedom sings. Join us now. next week, heed the call. Behind the woodshed, standing tall.